You're now listening to The Brian Callen Show with your host, Brian Callen.
Brian, it is.
I mean, just like what with, like, you know, all this money. I don't know what to do. Like, I'm an actor, so I have all this money, and then I put it in real estate, and then I make money on that, and then I open an orphanage, but it doesn't turn a profit. And
but you still have so much money, even though...
I'm trying to give these kids a skill. Like, yeah. You know, they're good cobblers. It doubles as a shoe factory. Ladies and gentlemen, once again, thank you, Marita. My lovely lady who cleans my house sometimes just brought me my coffee. I'm an aristocrat, ladies and gentlemen. This is Brian Callen. Of course, this is the one and only Brian Callen Show. Well, it's really the Hunter Mott Show, but I like to call it the Brian Callen Show. Hunter, I just had
isn't that the nature of being an aristocrat, Brian? Is it that you own shit and put your own name on it? I mean, that is the Trump way.
That is
even if other people do all the work.
That is the Trump way. Trump way is to do that and also advocate the killing of your rival. Because she's not your rival, she's your enemy. It's funny how when you define certain terms, knowing how to define and articulate the difference is actually a really good skill.
Yeah.
It's a really good way to check the debate, change minds, you know. To say... Hillary is not an enemy, she's a rival, is a good example of that. You know, that's not my wording. Somebody said that. I was listening to NPR. I listen to National Public Radio.
Wow.
And I'm not a leftist. You know, this guy was saying, there was this terrible YouTube video, and this guy was saying, here's why you should vote for Trump. He's an entrepreneur, number one. Number two, the people that vote for him are guys you'd like to have a beer with. And number three, the elites hate him.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, how do you define elites? You talking about people, and we're going to get into this because we wanted to talk about how to come up with simple answers, or as simple as it needs be. And apparently liberals like to create complex questions.
Well, they like to say that things that are complex, which is the sort of the cop-out, right? Yeah. So,
but again, they are sometimes. So when you say the elite, there are questions and problems that require a multifaceted approach, maybe, or that require first isolating what the problem is. That requires investigation. That requires experimentation, maybe. That requires an analysis of the available data. That might require new data. That might require a different approach at how you look at the problem. There are 1,000 ways to solve these problems.
And you must have
perspective, and you must be familiar with the scientific method. And so if that makes somebody an elitist, or if that makes them elite, it just makes them educated. And I think that's very necessary sometimes.
Well, see, George Bernard Shaw famously said that,
said that
all the economists...
By the way, the minute you say George Bernard Shaw said,
yeah.
you're already in the elite.
Oh, but I'm okay. But see, this is the thing, is that I think that, you know, Trump and sort of Trump supporters are right. Like, there is a tribe that is the global elite. You know,
yeah.
They went to a certain kind of school.
Yeah.
They value certain texts, right, like George Bernard Shaw, and they don't respect or value others,
yeah,
like the Bible,
yeah,
or the Quran.
Hmm.
So there's no question that that's the tribe. Now, the question is, do I belong to that tribe? I think to a certain extent, I also have a lot of discontents with that tribe.
You do. But tell me about George Bernard Shaw. I interrupted.
But so you. George Bernard Shaw said that all the economists in the world laid end to end would never reach a conclusion. So that's sort of the big problem here is that there's a lot of these sort of like false dichotomies that we have about complexity versus simplicity, right? Just as we have, there's a false dichotomy between theory and practice.
Well, it's another way of, let me paraphrase. My father used to always say, intellectuals never really come up with an answer and a
decision.
That's right. You're right. You can talk in circles. You can use the word "it depends" a lot.
Yeah.
You can use the word "context" a lot. You can sort of come up with different models with different outcomes. But at the end of the day, if you're a policymaker, you have to make a decision.
That's right. So there's a sort of intellectual cowardice and a lack of intellectual accountability that comes from just sort of saying, oh, it's complicated. The problem still needs to be studied. You know, we have to do more research and all that sort of stuff. And even if we don't have perfect answers, we have to come up with the best answer today that we can and then act on that.
But the problem with that is that you get yourself into a war. Like, let's just take Iraq. I would have argued that a wise man would have been prudent enough to say, first of all, he wouldn't have had the hubris to think he can restructure the Middle East. And he would have said something like, I don't know much about the history of this country, the culture of this country. I don't know much about the Arab psyche. I don't know much about how that society is structured. Therefore, it seems to me that containment, a no-fly zone, and all the things we have in place seem to be working. But you get people who say, here's the argument, and I think it was Henry Kissinger who came up with a very compelling argument. And he said, look, it's true that, you know, I suppose they have their own sovereignty, but you're talking about a guy who has a library on Stalin, who's hijacked the country. Oh, and by the way, when you are living in a world where technology can wipe out 100,000 or a million people in a flash, autonomy doesn't really hold water. I don't want a dangerous dude or a dangerous regime that would find something profitable in a mushroom cloud over a European or American city out there. And that's the world we're living in. Therefore, regime change not only is important for Iraq and the safety of our allies and ourselves, but it also sends a clear message to anybody else who thinks there's any value in supporting a radical group that would kill a bunch of us, or, you know, that argument I can see holding water, and that argument I can even see being enough to mobilize the use, quote unquote, of force.
But see, Brian, that's a great New York Times op-ed, but this is mixed mental arts. And that,
motherfuckers! Did you hear that, everybody?
And so the point is that we have to come to actual conclusions about how you practically engage with reality. Like, is it a good fight to watch two people dance around each other and never make any contact?
No.
If I'm overly aggressive and then get pinned down and defeated, do I win?
No.
And if I'm not aggressive enough, right, and therefore, you know, never properly engage and never pin down the other guy, do I win?
No.
So the point is, it's the great accountability of the octagon. And intellectually, that's what we have here at Mixed Mental Arts that the New York Times does not have.
You hear that noise, ladies and gentlemen?
Yeah.
That's a caveman. That's a caveman with a big brain noise.
But so we have to get very specific about what our mental models are, right? What are our beliefs? How do we understand the world operating? So if you want to take, for example, the Iraq War, I always think what's fascinating is that when George Bush the First was president of the United States, he invaded Iraq, and he stopped 100 miles outside of Baghdad. He left Saddam in place because he understood that although Saddam was, you know, a terrible dictator and, you know, did all sorts of terrible things to the people, that he was the strong man, and that the strong man held the country together and stopped the country from descending into sectarian violence, which would destabilize the entire region. So, you know, and we've now had in the last, you know, decade, there's a whole bunch of strongmen that have been taken out all over the world. Gaddafi was taken out, and then Libya fell into sectarian violence. And I'll tell you, we've had that great story that we told before. I don't know if we told it on air, right, about Gaddafi and the bag of rats.
Yeah, we might have, but tell it anyway.
Yeah. So there are three people in a race. This is a story that the Libyans tell. There are three people in a foot race, and each of them has a bag of rats, and they have to try and make it to the finish line. And the first guy runs, and he makes it about 100 feet, and then the rats chew their way out of the bag. The second guy makes it about 200 feet, and again, the rats chew their way out of the bag. And the third guy runs, but the whole time he shakes the bag so that the rats never get organized enough to chew their way out of the bag. And he finishes and wins the foot race.
Yeah.
And that third guy is Gaddafi.
Yeah.
And that's what these strong men do well, is that they keep all the factions fighting each other enough that they never get organized enough to take out the strong man.
It's great.
So it's great. Our mental model may be that we decide that although, you know, people like Saddam or Gaddafi are terrible, right, that it's much, much worse to let it's much, much worse to take those guys out and let the country fall back into sectarian violence. There's an old Arab saying, which is that it is better to live 1,000 years in tyranny than one day in anarchy.
Is that true?
Yeah.
We have to be careful about Arab sayings, because that might mean that's a representation of the Arab psyche. But I would imagine.
But hold on,
all of us crave order, especially as you get older. I mean, I anarchy is where I don't know what's going to happen to my children.
That's
my
right.
My wife's going to get raped in gangs form.
It's the
problem with libertarians like the radical libertarians, mm-hmm. or our dear friend Michael Malice. What Michael doesn't really understand is that when you have anarchy. Like that, gangs do form. They do.
Oh, 100%.
Cartels take over. There are people willing to do terrible things,
mm-hmm.
In the name of power. There are sociopaths out there that are smart enough to, you know, you got to be very careful with
that. And you don't have to go overseas to see that. You can go to South Central. Yeah. When there is a vacuum of authority,
yes.
Then what happens is that, yes, gangs form.
Yeah.
This is not saying anything again, because this is mixed mental arts. Mm. We're not saying anything about the Arab psyche.
Right.
We're saying something that is universal to human beings, right? And so the big difference between us is not our hardware. All people have basically the same hardware, but we have very different cultural software.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, to use like a simple mental model, right, but not a mental model that is simplistic, that is so simple that it doesn't capture things, is that, you know, there are essentially three big stages for societies. The first, and this comes from Fukuyama, right, so the first is that there's a monopoly on legitimate violence. And that's what someone like Gaddafi or Saddam Hussein has. So the point is, the only person who gets
the person in control of really the armed forces.
That's
really,
right. Yeah. And the only person who is legally allowed to kill people is the dictator.
Yeah.
Now, although that system has many terrible things about it, what it does is it removes violence as a tool for conflict resolution between people.
Yeah.
So what that means is that if you have a land dispute with your neighbor, or if your neighbor does something, you don't just go out to go and kill people.
Yeah.
Right? And that's the war of all against all that Hobbes talks about in the Leviathan. Mm-hmm. That's the sort of the state of nature, is that they have band level genocide. So tribes are constantly wiping each other out.
Which, you know, is common.
Right.
In the, you know, Polynesian islands, mm-hmm. There are a lot of stories about that.
Papua New Guinea.
Yeah. I mean, you would go in and take out an entire tribe, especially if, and Jared Diamond talked about
yeah.
that, especially as soon as resources got scarce,
mm-hmm.
It was very easy for people to create legitimate and even ethical, quote unquote, reasons for why those people over there are the biggest scumbag subhumans to walk the earth.
Well, and crucially, what you're doing is that you're reframing the emotions that you have about these people. Right?
I think all the time about how the guy who wrote Bloodlands, who we had on the mm-hmm. podcast a while back,
Snyder.
Snyder said, you're amazing that you remember this. Snyder said, I write about these terrible events in history, and, you know, when Stalin starved all those people, you know, how could it happen? Could it happen again? I have a daughter in kindergarten. If water rights were a very real issue and I couldn't get enough water for my family, I wonder what I would do.
Yeah.
I think about that. You know, when your very existence is up against it, or even your dignity, you know.
100%.
Fuck, man. I get mad when somebody cuts me off.
Right. But again, what we have what you're seeing there is that there's no difference between us and those Papua New Guineans in terms of our hardware, right? We all have the capacity for disgust. And every genocide is based on framing other human beings as disgusting. Mm. That's why you always hear them referred to as vermin, rats, cockroaches, right? The most famous is the Jews in, you know, Nazi Germany. They frame them as vermin. But you find the same thing with all of them. So in the Hutus and the Tutsis, the Rwandan genocide, the word word that was used for the Tutsis was Inyenzi, which is the Kiswahili word for, is it Kiswahili? I can't remember what the language is, but whatever the language is, Inyenzi means cockroach. Mm-hmm. And so it's always again and again, and if you remember, that's what Jared Diamond talks about, is that in half an hour, these two tribes that live next to each other, one of the tribes manages to tell all these made-up stories to convince itself that these other people are disgusting.
Well, I think the Japanese, you know, indoctrinated their soldiers by telling them the Chinese eat their own children.
Right.
And these were Japanese, you know, they were just kids who wanted to make the world a better place and defend Japan. Mm-hmm. You know, David Robinson said something, another thing I always think about is, he said, people don't go to war over hate. They go to war because they're trying to defend something they love.
100%.
Right? You mobilize armies under slogan and propaganda.
And that's idea. That's the opposing emotion to disgust, is sanctity. Mm. Right? There's something sacred that we're defending and something disgusting that we have to eliminate. Mm. But so these...
Yeah, people should read, or at least there's a book called The Nobility of Failure. I'm repeating myself, but these kamikaze who wrote these beautiful haiku poems back mm-hmm. to their families before they, you know, crashed their planes in the U.S. destroyers. And the idea was that they... And most of them, very few were mathematicians or engineers. Most of them were students of the humanities. They were romantics. They were romantics. And they wrote quite beautiful poems. Mm-hmm. So, yeah.
And that's the point, is that it's these emotions that are channeled towards some sort of end. But so... If you think about band level genocide, right, and living in a situation where literally, you know, the neighboring tribe can come over and wipe you out to the last generation, right, mm-hmm. killing all the children and all that sort of stuff, it makes a person like Gaddafi, who for all of his terrible behavior, at least prevents that constantly being wiped out by your neighbors. It's comparatively appealing. Mm-hmm. But so that monopoly on legitimate violence is sort of the first stage. The second stage is the rule of law. And this is the stage that is always missed out. Americans have told themselves so many myths about their own democracy. We tend to think, oh, we had this terrible dictator, King George III, and then overnight we went to this amazing democracy. But in fact, you know, our buddies who wrote Why Nations Fail, Darren Acemoglu and James Robinson, there was this event that happened in England 100 years before that in 1660, which was the Glorious Revolution, where the king was made to follow the law. The law was placed above the king, and that's rule of law. Mm. And so what that means is that after for 100 years, the American colonists grew up with the intuition that if we have conflicts, we go to the courts and we solve them in the courts, and that everybody has to follow these laws. But so with 100 years of that, 116 years of that under their belts, that meant that they could then transition to democracy. What happens is, and this is again Fukuyama, the problem is that with something like the French Revolution, they tried to leapfrog from stage one to stage three without going through stage two, because the Louis were all absolute monarchs. They were guys like Gaddafi or Saddam Hussein. They weren't accountable to the law, and they'd never gone through that period of rule of law. And so what ends up happening is you remove that dictator, right? The French Revolution was the Arab Spring of hundreds of years mm-hmm. ago, and then it all descends into sectarian violence, where you have the terror, and everybody's heads are being chopped off, and there are these, you know, mass persecutions.
The revolution devoured its own children.
That's right.
Yes.
But that's always one of the big questions.
And along comes a charismatic leader.
Napoleon.
Exactly.
But Napoleon crucially establishes the Napoleonic Code and sort of begins this transition, and they go through essentially this long process where suddenly rule of law is established. Mm-hmm. And once rule of law is established, then you can have the transition to democracy.
There were a lot of like rudimentary property rights, due process, and all those things, right? I mean, those were the Napoleonic laws.
Yeah. I mean, it's a reclaim.
Until he decided, of course.
Well, it's a complex and it's a messy process, but what you're seeing is you're seeing sort of a universal human transition where you have to establish rule of law before you can effectively transition to democracy. Mm-hmm. But so, you know, this is not a thing about Arabs or French people. It's a thing about humans and having to reframe those norms and values. And again, the whole point is that I've given you a 1-2-3 model, which is to replace a 1-2 model, right, of going straight from dictator to democracy. Now, that's a great example. Is that an exhaustive model? Have I dealt with all the nuances and intricacies? No. It is as simple as possible, but no simpler. and is a as a sort of framework to start from. If every American approached foreign policy from a 1-2-3 model rather than a 1-2 model, we would have a very, very different approach to foreign policy, right? So it's elegant, right?
But you're saying we'd have a different approach to foreign policy if those leaders took into account the notion of rule of law and legitimate violence?
And not just the leaders, but the people.
So in other words, make sure that those two mechanisms are not shattered or destroyed in the process of regime change, is what you're
well,
saying,
or influencing
a coup or whatever.
If you're looking at a guy like Saddam Hussein,
yeah.
you would understand, see, Americans sort of have, again, like...
Well, good guy, bad guy.
That's right. Yep. And very, very simple.
And the minute good, I mean, when Bush signed the authorization of the use of force, he said, let freedom reign. He
That's
wrote
right.
that down. Like, well, woohoo, rejoice, everybody. Mission accomplished. And now the Arab people will be free and there will be daffodils in the streets.
That's
it,
right.
It is. It's a good guy, bad guy.
And it's,
that's where, to me, George Bush W was not wise.
Right.
He was not, frankly, he, like, you know, I that's something I would do. You know, I mean, I don't like to be too critical, but I think of the world.
Is that
in
the
these,
worst criticism these, you could think of? Is that it's something I
yes,
would do?
Yes, I mean, these are the kind of, I think in these terms. I think in these terms, and then I would have advisors like you who would say, Brian, sober thinkers who have more perspective, who would say, Brian, Mr. President, Brian Callen, you know, no, and here's why. And then I would hope that my mind would be changed and I would exercise some prudence and say, okay, I get that, but...
But don't you think
he
we
didn't
should
do that?
Don't you think we should find out by getting you elected president and see how you would respond?
Look, man, if you're telling me I should run for president, Hunter, I'm so busy with all my TV and
yeah.
my boxing and my tennis and
yeah.
my sex. You know, I
but
got
don't,
stuff
you don't think
do.
You don't think you would have time for all of those things in the White House?
Does the White House have a tennis court and a boxing ring?
They,
I got to take my boxing more
they've
seriously.
They've got a bowling alley.
We could turn that into something.
We could, yeah, I think we could totally build a tennis court. And by the way, just to, you know, in terms of the logistics,
yeah.
right? Who's your tennis coach right now?
A guy named Afshin.
Okay, I've never heard of him. If you were the president of the United States, we could get Pete Sampras and Andre Agassi to be your tennis coaches. And how much faster would you improve at tennis?
A lot faster.
So then you'd have time to wrestle with Syria and Iraq.
That's the biggest thing. That's what stopped me from the tour. Better tutelage in tennis.
But I think that if you went to the American people and said, you know, like, I'm improving at tennis, like, sort of like in a linear way.
Yes.
And if I was president, I could improve in an exponential way.
Yes.
Then they'd be like, oh, your tennis would get
oh,
this is what matters. Is
got
how good
it.
Brian Callen is at tennis.
Got you. Yes. Yes.
Think about it, Brian's tennis playing ability.
That's very funny.
But I mean, I think that's the, you know, this does also sort of get to the point of what makes a great president. And I think it's the willingness to listen and the willingness to be wrong and the willingness to improve your thinking.
Yeah.
But the interesting thing again is that, you know, the team that decided to stop 100 miles out of Baghdad, right, in the first Gulf War, and the team that decided to take Saddam Hussein out a decade later, virtually the same team.
My
it's
God.
Colin Powell, Dick Cheney. And, you know, instead of George Bush 1, it's George Bush 2.
Well, even wasn't Wolfowitz involved in the... Paul Wolfowitz was involved
yep.
in the... Yeah. And was instrumental in creating the no-fly zone in, mm-hmm. in Kurdistan, too, I think. You know,
so, the point is that, you know, it wasn't that they got... That they didn't know this. It's that they got dumber, right? They got a more simplistic model. They got too simple in their model and didn't understand that taking out a dictator is very often a bad idea.
Yeah.
And so the question is...
Well, especially when Iran is your neighbor and you have a huge
yeah.
Shia population and yeah, there's a lot of things.
But the point is to realize that if you are too simple, then you get screwed. But if you also cop out and say, well, everything is super complex, you're also screwed. And that either one is a cop out. And you have to go back and forth and try and find some sort of model that is realistic but usable.
Mm.
And the problem is that when you have all this, you know, it's basically like a great piece of software. right? So there's this problem that they always talk about in Silicon Valley, which is featureitis, whereas essentially over time, a piece of software, they just keep on adding features and adding features and adding features and adding features. And it seems like things are getting better because now it can do a million and one things. Mm. But that feature creep actually makes the thing less usable. And so it gets worse. The great thing about something like an Apple product is that it is this amazing trade-off. It is a trade-off between having, you know, features and power and control and usability and simplicity and all this other stuff on the other side. And so that's what we want for our thinking in Mixed Mental Arts.
Well, because I said to you, you remember a lot of stuff, and you said, I'm always organizing my brain.
Yeah.
You know, and
which
I said,
I don't do with my apartment.
You don't do that with your apartment, but you are paleo, so you do it a little bit with your body. But yeah. You're always organizing your brain. So give us an example of that.
Well, so that's the point, is that, you know, a great example is with students, right? Mm. So you'll be working with them on math, and they'll tend to say, this is hard, I can't do it. But hard is just saying that you...
Are they Mickey Mouse?
They are Mickey Mouse. Good, good. I only work with Disney characters.
Good, good, good. Yeah, that might be the first problem, but keep going.
I've actually never worked with a human being.
Okay, so. Mickey, here's the thing. Pin your ears back, first of all. There's no room in here for that. I am speaking in a normal voice. It's just your ears are giant. So that's why it sounds like I'm shouting.
But so they say that things are hard, right? Mm. And when something is clear, when you know what you're doing, it's easy. So really when people are saying that things are hard, what they're telling you is they don't have clarity. And so what you have to do is that you have to force the student to some sort of clarity that consistently delivers a right answer. And so it's the same thing. What you constantly want to be doing is you want to be pushing yourself to a clarity that is able to explain all behavior, right?
Well, it was like, I never forgot when Aubrey de Grey was talking about the seven mechanisms by which a cell breaks down. And I was like, well, you're using words like mitochondria.
Yeah, exactly.
And you're like, Brian, just listen. It's just a mechanical thing. Just listen to it. You can clarify. It's one step at a time.
That's right.
Which is why I'm an expert on cell degeneration.
Wow. Keep going. Which should make you a great president.
Duh. One thing I can tell you is the cell degenerates in seven different ways. My fellow Americans. So go on.
But that's the point, is that you...
Show clarity.
Yeah, and you're constantly testing your thinking to see... What can you make sense of? What can you not make sense of? Where it's the same thing as, you know, as MMA. You're trying to find where are the holes in my thinking, right? What can I not handle? And at the same time, you're also trying to make sure that you can actually know how to fix problems.
Well, the holes in my thinking, I mean, to bring it back to me, because
yes, that's what matters.
But I was thinking about that I have this weird, this deep desire to try to fix things, as a lot of us do.
Mm-hmm.
And I always seem to go, in a lot of ways, to the simplistic version. So let's just take two terrible...
No, I think, to be fair, you're bipolar. You either go to the simplistic version, or you're like, it's so complicated, no one can figure it out.
Right.
And what we want to do is that we want to go back and forth between those sorts of things until we find a clarity of understanding that is able to fix things, but is also usable.
I know, but sometimes, like, let's take, like, the drug cartels.
Right.
And I read about what the terrible things they do. And I say these things to myself. I'm like, God damn it, just get the army or the police in there and just take them all out.
Right.
Well, what do you mean take them all out? And then you start to realize, well, they force people. ISIS is the same way. They go to your family and say, join us or we're going to kill everybody here. And
right.
You just have to join them. So now, and then you start to realize that the police and the army are being paid off and they're involved. Then you start to realize maybe even the president's brother is being paid off. And then you realize it's so systemic that there is no bad guy, or everybody's a bad guy and everybody's a good guy. And all of a sudden you go, I don't know how to fix this problem, but it ain't going to be done with a gun. My first reaction is I want to go in there with special forces teams and kill the bad guys and make the villagers live in peace, just like in all the westerns, you know. In the westerns, in High Plains Drifter, you know, Clint Eastwood comes in with a piece of hickory and his six shooter, and he kills the bad guys and liberates the town.
Right.
That is my way of thinking. It's been crammed down my throat.
Right.
And of course, we know not only is the problem way more complicated and the bad guys are everywhere and nowhere, maybe there is no goddamn answer. And maybe the answer might be legalized drugs.
But, well, firstly, we know that there is an answer. There are societies that have been built where you don't have these sorts of problems, right? But already we can apply some of the thinking that we've learned. So why are there gangs in South Central, right? That's also drug cartels. Let's talk about why do those gangs exist?
That's the better question. Let's start there.
Right, because we've had Freeway Rick Ross on.
Yeah.
And there you have a guy. Is Freeway Rick Ross smart?
He's very smart.
Right.
The answer may very well be, you're right, the answer may very well be, you know, two-pronged, three-pronged approach. One is law and order, but the other is get to the systemic issues here. I mean, the biggest issue in Mexico may very well be what Darren Acemoglu and those guys talk about, which is the lack of integrity in their institutions.
And
monopolies are what stifle any kind of new business, mm-hmm. any new ingenuity. You're either a cartel owner, or you already have your foot in the economy of influence that is Mexico.
Right. So if you look at Freeway Rick Ross, here's a guy who's smart, right? You know, clearly is resourceful and all this sort of stuff. But the problem is that he doesn't have a clear path to succeeding within the system. So he tries to succeed outside the system. Mm. And this is the whole thing with a place like Mexico. And one of the, you know, Darren Acemoglu and James Robinson talk about this in Why Nations Fail, right? If you're a poor guy in Mexico, it's not that there's a path by which you then go on to, you know, run a big business. It's not an inclusive system. Mm. It's all based on connections. It's all based on family. The system is corrupt. You need to be able to buy your way in. You need to buy influence and all that sort of stuff. So if you have a system that gives people a path to success where the system is open and easy to enter, then a lot of these problems start to disappear.
Good luck.
Well, again, it's going to take work, and these things are challenging. And
they,
again,
they're not
it's
even challenging. They require a change in mindset.
Oh, 100%.
In national psyche.
Oh, 100%.
They require an altering of your culture.
100%.
Back to the secret of our success.
Right? And that's the point, is we have to change certain values and intuitions, right? So we have to change values and intuitions around learning, right? So mistakes are something you embrace and analyze and use to get better. When you feel confused, you don't run from that confusion, which was your experience with Aubrey de Grey, but instead you're like confused and you're like, that's okay, let me go and break this thing down, right? You value challenges, you value learning, you value books, you value all these sorts of things. So there's a whole bunch of intuitions around learning that you have to change. You also have to change intuitions around fairness. So again, we talked about this in terms of the Arab world, where everybody is focused on helping their family, and so they engage in corruption, as opposed to in the West, where we believe much more in meritocracy and fairness and in, you know, hiring the best person for the job, regardless of whether you're related to them. So there's a whole bunch of intuitions that we have to change, but there's no reason why a place like Mexico or Libya, there are human beings there, and if you get those values and intuitions right, and the institutions right, then you can have the same sort of success that you have in the United States or in the West.
We should be optimistic, too, because it feels like the better ideas are winning the day overall,
well,
because of example.
But see, let's talk about, see, there's a feeling there, right? And this is a feeling that we talked about last time.
It's more than a feeling, though, because the most of Latin America, most of Europe, yes, there are problems. Yes, we go back and forth. But for the most part, the ideas that you just laid out, the intuitions that you laid out on, maybe not so much about learning, we have a long way to go, but certainly about democracy.
Well, so
women's rights are human rights. LGBT rights are human rights. These are, if Russia's not holding those to account, they have to defend them on the international stage. At least places like Russia and parts of the Middle East that are oppressive are being held, at least they're being criticized vocally, held to task.
But see here, Brian,
forced to defend themselves.
The first thing is, it's never more than a feeling. All we have are feelings. I may feel that the world is going in a good direction or a bad direction, right? And I can then arrange the facts to support that conclusion. Mm. But the point is, it's always just a feeling. And the question is, what feeling leads to the actions that lead to the result that I want?
Mm.
So what does your feeling about the direction of the world lead to? what behavior does it lead you to take?
Complacency.
Exactly. Which does not lead you to, is complacency a good feeling to have about how good your fighting style is in MMA?
Well, I mean, you're talking, I mean, I'm like water when I fight, but let's just say I'm a normal man.
But if you're preparing for a fight, is complacency a good feeling?
No.
What feeling is the most useful one?
I would imagine a sense of urgency.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And so the point is that whether we can arrange the facts in whatever we weigh about the direction of the world, but the useful feeling is urgency. That we have to act now, and there are things we have to do better. And if you look at, for example, a place like Silicon Valley, there is an urgency, right? Then that urgency leads them to constantly be working to improve.
Yeah, because the barbarians are at the gate.
That's right.
Right? Yeah.
And so if you look at all the academics that we've interviewed, do they have a sense of urgency about the movement of ideas?
Exactly.
Do they?
That's a good question.
Yeah.
Love this, by the way.
Yeah.
Because you isolated exactly what the problem was. If you take an optimistic outlook, which is always a good thing, it might get in the way of not only the need to make changes that are necessary and make you complacent, mm-hmm. because what you're doing is that crucial flaw of looking at your immediate surroundings and choosing emotionally to look at what's good as opposed to what's wrong.
And part of what you love about MMA is how fast the sport is improving.
Mm-hmm.
And that's because there is no complacency.
You can. You'll get knocked
out. That's right. But if we look at, we've now interviewed over 200 academics, they're all remarkably complacent about the movement of ideas, right?
Yeah, and I think that's part of human nature. I mean, and also sometimes when problems seem so big, for example, global warming.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know how to cool the planet.
But is the issue cooling the planet, or is the issue, because we can go back to our friend Naomi Oreskes and Eric Conway, is the issue understanding, or is the issue doubt?
That's a good question, but I would also suggest there's another factor, and that is that sometimes when, it's so interesting, when you have this idea that the polar ice cap might melt, which could set off a whole rising sea levels and biblical, sort of consequences of biblical proportions, most of us, a lot of people kind of go, well, God would never do that to us. In other words, I mean, there becomes this fatalistic sort of mentality.
Well,
and that fatalistic mentality can have really tragic and catastrophic consequences. Well, what will be if it's meant to be. That's a bullshit way to think a lot of times. It might be comforting to help you negotiate and navigate big disappointments or tragedy in your life, and there's a place for that. But when it comes to solving problems, my buddy was a Navy SEAL, SEAL Team 6 guy, saw a lot mm-hmm. of action. He said the one thing I came away with is that nothing is left to chance. I mean, I have no time for anything but, empirical, fact-driven analysis that's going to lead to an outcome.
Right.
Because otherwise people die.
That's right. Yeah. And so the point is that the issue with global warming is the feeling about global warming, right?
Mm-hmm.
There's a feeling of doubt. Does it really matter? Is it going to affect me? On what sort of timeline? Now, there's...
And not only that, but also there are a lot of people who say, like my parents would say, I've seen this play out before. They talked about we were going to starve to death. They talked about a lot of stuff. We're going to run out of resources. And it's just a bunch of hysterics. The warmists are always liberals. They always have beards. They always wear tie-dye. And they shouldn't be taken so seriously because at the end of the day, they're hysterics.
Well, and see, this is the crucial thing, right? There's the way this conversation usually goes is that we now try and wade into a bunch of climate science that most of us do or do not understand. Right? But the great thing about mixed mental arts is that we're pragmatists. We're practical. Right? Mm-hmm. And so the
Which was almost the point of Merchants of Doubt, to bring it back, because Oreskes said, these are not crazy men. What's going on here? It was an ideology. They were defending free market principles and
mm-hmm.
and freedom and small government. That's
totally
what they were. The scientists who were sowing doubt weren't even climatologists.
Right. And so what is the practical actions that need to change, right, to prevent global warming? If you think global warming is real, right? You have to get us off of fossil fuels. Mm-hmm. That's the crucial thing. But there are reasons to get off fossil fuels besides global warming.
Mm-hmm.
What is it that funds ISIS overwhelmingly? Well, right. A whole lot of that money comes from selling oil.
Mm-hmm.
So if you remove the market for oil, then you remove the funding for most of these unstable, shitty nations, things like ISIS and all of that sort of stuff.
Whether or not that's true, that's a good argument. That's certainly a good emotional argument to get the other side on board.
It's a lot of it is true.
Yeah.
Because, for example, there's always liberals tend to advance this narrative that, oh, it's about the oil, stupid, that's why we're going into Iraq and all of that sort of stuff. The U.S. is actually remarkably energy independent.
Mm-hmm.
So the reason why we're trying to secure that oil is not for the U.S., it's for our allies like Japan,
mm-hmm.
who have very few resources.
Mm-hmm.
So American troops are not dying for America. They're dying for Japan.
Yeah.
And so the point is that it's actually, if you...
I mean, haven't we safeguarded all those trade routes free of charge for
exactly.
World War II?
Yeah. So if you want to secure Japan's energy, which is a good thing to do because you don't want Japan to go to crap, right?
Mm-hmm.
But then one of the best ways to do that is to drive renewable energy. So driving electric cars like you do, Brian, is a deeply patriotic act. And
well, except for my Tesla has a bigger footprint than carbon footprint than almost any other car.
But Brian, you're driving technologies and making it more efficient so that ultimately
road. If I were someone else, full disclosure, I don't give a fuck about that. I just wanted a safe, very fast, cool looking car. But anyway,
But that's the whole point. The whole point is that what Elon Musk has done, which is smart, is that he has not sold this based on global warming or based on any of that sort of stuff. He sold it based on cool.
Yeah.
And so,
I mean, you know, there was an expression that Tesla douche. In this show, the guy who steals the guy's girlfriend is a Tesla douche.
Mm-hmm.
He rides a Tesla.
Yeah.
And now all of a sudden you're a douche if you ride a cool electric car. Holy shit. I can't win.
But I mean, the point is that there are lots of practical reasons for getting off oil that have nothing to do with climate change or global warming.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, you know, and there are good books on this, like Blood Oil, but you know, oil and resources and all that sort of stuff. If you're a stable country like Norway, then that money ends up being funneled into rising prosperity for the nation. If you're a country like Nigeria, that money goes into corruption. It makes the country less stable, right? Mm. It's the resource curse, or Dutch oil disease, Dutch disease, as it's sometimes called, because essentially all of this cheap money messes the country up.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, there are good reasons like development and stability and national security for wanting to get off oil that have nothing to do with whether climate change is real or not. So if we're talking to someone like Big Mike, your dad, right, we're not going to convince him that global warming is real, but we don't need to convince him that global warming is real. There are other good reasons to get off of oil.
Right.
But again, the question is what, you know, you said it's more than a feeling. It is never more than a feeling. There is always just a feeling. So if you've got some MMA guy, right, maybe complacency is correct. Maybe they're so far ahead of the game, they've already figured out everything, and they're going to win. But complacency leads them to not make whatever improvements they can in the months up to a fight. And
right.
So they choose the feeling of urgency.
Yeah.
And so you have the ability, whether we're talking about competing, you know, for a job or, you know, improving your skills or dealing with any sort of big issue, you can choose urgency. And by choosing urgency, you make sure that you're constantly doing whatever you can do to improve.
I love that.
Yeah. So you choose the feeling that serves your success.
I absolutely love that is the conclusion that we've come to. I actually learned something today.
Yeah.
Which is why I really crave these conversations once a week. And you guys should know that Hunter is the one who drives this thing. It was always like, hey, let's podcast. I'm busy doing things that have way more to do with my pocketbook than they do my intellectual growth.
It's almost like Hunter is trying to groom you for something, Brian.
Uh-huh. I'm going to drop this as dropping knowledge on the fighter and the kid. I want to get this idea out there, and then I'm going to tell them that if they want to hear an extrapolation of that, come over to the Brian Callen show.
Come back to my name.
Come back to my name.
But that's the great thing about UFC and MMA is the fact that, you know, there you're seeing a culture that is an effective culture. Right, because it chooses urgency, it looks for holes and mistakes, it's constantly trying to prove. And the same thing that is done with fighting can also be done with mental, in the mental arena, and understanding and creating better models and all of that sort of stuff.
Yeah.
But well, that's, Brian, what do you think?
That's a great way to organize your brain. You just gave me a reason why I have to be very cautious of an optimistic outlook.
Yeah, well, you shouldn't over-favor one mindset or another.
Yes, exactly.
Right?
Exactly.
But Brian, what do you think I'm trying to groom you for?
I think you're trying to groom me for the presidency of the United States of America, my fellow Americans.
Exactly, Brian.
This is the beginning of my candidacy.
The point is, yeah, we're training
if
we
can,
you.
If you can just whitewash the atrocious behavior that I have engaged in over the past 20 years, we'll be fine.
But see, that's the thing, Brian, is that if there's anything that an evangelical loves, it's a repentant man.
I throw myself at the altar of mercy.
I have seen the scales have fallen from my eyes like Saul on the road to Damascus.
Sin was my specialty.
And now I have renounced the ways of Satan.
The only thing I will not give up is the arts of perversion, ladies and gentlemen.
But that only gives you another chance to like come clean and be born again.
Indeed. Is it perverted if you're not touching but just watching? That's the question of the day, ladies and gentlemen. Hunter Munch, I think we leave it at that. It's a tight and neat nugget. We have this tendency to. I have this tendency. We'll go an hour. I don't think you need that. Mm-mm. I think we did it.
Yep.
Thank you, sir.
Okay, and also, Brian, I think what you've been doing is like, what's the exercise at the end, right? What is the thing that we could do before next week?
I don't know.
Well, here's my suggestion. Mm. Right, is that so the big difference between MMA in the ring and mixed mental arts is that you already have a bunch of mental habits. So we're not necessarily always teaching you new things. We're trying to train you out of old habits. So the key is, one of the key things for mixed mental arts is to watch your own mind at work. See where it goes, reflect on those behaviors and see if they make sense. Are you using urgency to speed up your progress, or are you choosing complacency? And can you replace complacency with urgency so that you improve faster?
That is an incredible question to which I will ruminate on.
Oh, Brian, are you a ruminant?
I've used that word twice today.
And where does ruminate come from?
From ruminants?
Yeah.
That would be to chew your cud for
That's
a long
right.
time.
That's right. Exactly.
The equivalent of Sherlock Holmes smoking his pipe.
Uh-huh.
As he comes to a conclusion.
And what's in his pipe?
Well, it was at times opium.
Yeah.
And there's a whole section of the Sir Arthur Conan Doyle series where he's battling his addiction.
He also had liked a 7% solution of cocaine. Mm, he was a big fan of his drugs.
I forgot about that. God damn it.
But you know why?
A lot of people don't realize it. Yeah.
Do you know why Conan Doyle did that?
Drug addict. Why?
Because he hated his character. Like, he created this thing that everybody loved and everybody just wanted more of that. And as a writer, he felt trapped. And so he tried to make Holmes more unlikable. But the problem was that it just made him more complex and fascinating.
You're damn right.
He tried to destroy
him. He was amazing.
Him.
Sir Arthur Conan Doyle. If you guys haven't read the Sherlock Holmes series, I did it as a young guy.
They're amazing.
No, they're amazing.
And also the BBC version with Benedict Cumberbatch.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, Benedict it's really good.
I haven't seen it.
Oh, you haven't? It's really good.
Sherlock Holmes?
It's, or Sherlock, I think they just call it. Yeah.
I'll have to watch it.
It's on Netflix.
I love it.
Do you know what else is going to be on Netflix soon, Brian?
No.
Your comedy special.
You hear that, ladies and gentlemen? Go get it. Don't walk, run. Thank you once again to Hunter Motz.
Thank you to Brian Cowan.
And to you, my listeners. And I think we're changing the world one step at a time. Brian Cowan for president.
Once you're in the White House, you'll really change the world.
Yeah.
You've been listening to The Brian Cowan Show with Brian Cowan. Be sure to like him on Facebook. Just search for Brian Cowan Comedy. And follow him on Twitter. Just search for @BrianCowan. You can also find him online by visiting his website. Just go to briancowan.com. Until next time, bye-bye.